headlines. The Syrian army says its air defences have confronted an Israeli attack on the cities of Damascus and Homs. A confidential UN document accuses the Taliban of intensifying a search for people who worked with the US and NATO forces in Afghanistan. Also ahead, Burkina Faso's government says 80 people have been killed in a militant attack against a convoy of civilians and military personnel in the north of the country. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, the Syrian army says the country's air defences have repelled an Israeli attack on the cities of Damascus and Homs. The army reported that the Israeli warplanes launched the missiles from Lebanese airspace. Earlier we were joined by our Damascus correspondent Mohammed Ali, who gave us more details on the incident.
At about 11 p.m. local time here in Syria, loud sounds of Syrian air defences being activated was heard by the residents of the capital. Then an official military source in Damascus gave out a statement confirming that it was an Israeli attack and giving some details, saying that Israeli fighter jets carried out an aerial attack using a number of missiles from the direction of southeastern Lebanon, meaning this attack, as usual, Israel used Lebanese airspace in attacking Syria. Now, the Israeli fighter jets attacked areas around the Syrian capital, Damascus, and other areas around the central city of Homs. According to the official military source in Syria, Syrian air defenses were able to intercept the missiles and shoot down most of them. And currently, the statement concluded the Syrian army is assessing the damages or the results of the attack.
More than 50 U.S. Democratic lawmakers have urged President Joe Biden's administration to ensure that Israel and Egypt allow humanitarian aid into the besieged Gaza Strip. In a letter to Secretary of State Antony Blinken, the lawmakers in the House of Representatives described the humanitarian situation in Gaza as, quote, untenable. They said the recent tensions between the Israelis and the Palestinians have left an estimated 1.3 million people in need of humanitarian assistance. The lawmakers noted that people in Gaza currently have severely limited access to clean water, food, medicine, and electricity. Gaza has been under a tight Israeli air and sea blockade since 2007. The crippling siege has brought Gaza's economy to its knees. The Lebanese president says the delay in the formation of a new government is due to politicians' increasing demands from Prime Minister-designate Najib Meqati. Michel Aoun expressed concern that the goal of the demands was to force Meqati to resign, which Aoun said he does not want. On Tuesday, Meqati described forming a government for Lebanon as a difficult arithmetic equation. He made the comment after a meeting with Aoun at the presidential palace. Lebanon's ruling elite had failed to form a new cabinet, that is, since Prime Minister Hassan Diab quit following last year's devastating explosion at Beirut's port. This has further deepened the country's economic crisis, which the World Bank has described as one of the world's worst since the 1850s. Mariam Saleh has reviewed reports by local Lebanese media about the demands different political factions are making for the upcoming government. Take a listen.
There was a lot of talk in the media just yesterday and today, but they both, the Prime Minister designate and the President, considered them as false claims. Some media said that President Aoun wants veto power, so he was calling and demanding for at least 9 or 10 ministers that are close to the president, or for some people they believe they are loyal to President Michel Aoun's group, which is the Free Patriotic Movement. Others are saying that the prime minister designate is trying to, or very much close to, the former prime ministers Saad Hariri and Fuad Zamora and others in order to try to gain some get some gains from this cabinet, which will live by, as some are saying, live by American and Saudi standards. All of this would not lead to the fact that we can certify that there will be a cabinet anytime soon. We are waiting to see if there will be any talks in the upcoming days. If not, early next week, we either have a cabinet or we have the prime minister designate stepping down.
A confidential United Nations document says the Taliban, contrary to their claims, are intensifying a search for people who worked with the United States and NATO forces. According to the document, the Taliban has priority lists of individuals it wants to arrest. The report says the people most at risk are the ones who had central roles in the Afghan military, police, and intelligence units. It notes that the Taliban have been conducting targeted door-to-door visits of individuals they want to apprehend. The document reported by AFP was written by the Norwegian Center for Global Analyses, an organization that provides intelligence to UN agencies. The Taliban, which came to power last week, pledged full amnesty for all who worked with the former Afghan government. Turkey says it will act in coordination with the international community in its stance on the recognition of the new government in Afghanistan. Roshan Saganam is in Istanbul.
Turkey says it will decide on Taliban's government recognition after it is formed. Turkish foreign minister said Ankara will not rush into recognizing a Taliban government in Afghanistan as it is still too early for this step.
We are keeping up dialogue with all sides, including the Taliban. We view positively the messages that the Taliban have given so far, whether to foreigners, diplomatic individuals, or its own people. We hope to see these in action as well.
In response to a question regarding Turkey's contact with the Taliban, Çavuşoğlu said Turkey had invited the political wing of the Taliban to Turkey before they had entered Kabul. Earlier, Turkish security sources said Ankara had dropped plans to guard and operate Kabul's airport after the withdrawal of NATO forces from Afghanistan, following footage and reports of chaos taking place there after Taliban's takeover. Turkey says its offer to provide technical and security assistance at the Kabul airport will be further discussed with the U.S.
Turkey will follow the lead of other countries in recognizing a Taliban government in Afghanistan. If the U.S. and EU countries recognize a government formed by Taliban, Turkey will follow in their footsteps. However, I don't think that Turkey will consider the Taliban government as a strategic partner in the region. We expect a delegation from the Taliban to visit Turkey for talks over the transition phase, just like it is taking place with other countries in the region.
The Turkish president had announced last week his readiness to meet with the Taliban leadership. Turkey says so far the Taliban is sending positive messages, hoping that it will be followed with positive actions as well. Turkey is now concerned about the refugee influx it is going to have after Taliban's takeover in Afghanistan. This comes as it has been struggling to revive the economic situation in the country, with a handful of refugees already there amid the coronavirus pandemic. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
In the wake of the recent developments in Afghanistan, Iran has seen a steady influx of Afghan refugees. Iran's border police have set up temporary camps alongside the country's eastern border to host the inbound refugees. Yusuf Jalali was there and filed this report from the Iranian-Afghan border.
Panicked and distressed, Afghans continue to seek refuge in Iran as they face a dim future in their country. As ex-Afghan President Ashraf Ghani fled his country and ceded power to the Taliban, Iran's eastern borders have seen an unabated influx of Afghans who seek a new life in Iran. Some used to be wealthy businessmen who have lost their possessions in the conflict, and others are simply concerned about the future of their children. But all wind up here in this camp, where they have to wait for a decision by Iranian authorities whether to let them in or send them back to their country.
I ask the Iranian government to allow us to stay here until the situation improves in our country. If we were not forced to, we would have not deserted our homeland.
I have nothing to lose. There is no future for me and my children in Afghanistan. I came to Iran as my last hope to build a future for my two kids.
How can I raise my kids in my country? My husband has lost everything. We spent all we have to get to Iran.
Iran's border police have set up makeshift camps alongside the country's eastern border with Afghanistan to temporarily accommodate the inbound refugees. Milak Crossing Point in Sistan and Balochistan is one of the border crossings that has seen the entry of more than 600 Afghans every day since the Taliban began advancing in Afghanistan. The Iranian armed forces say they have received incoming Afghans with open arms, providing them with all the relief items such as masks and disinfectants, food and medicine.
Over the past week, Iran's armed forces have spared no effort to accommodate our Afghan brothers and sisters who have sought refuge in our country. It's our duty first as human beings and then as Muslims who share the same language and culture to offer services to our troubled neighbor.
The collapse of the Afghan army and the government began with U.S. President Joe Biden's implementation of his predecessor's planned troop withdrawal after two decades of presence on the Afghan soil, something which Afghans say has yielded nothing but destruction and bloodshed for their country.
The U.S. invaded our country in 2001 under pretext of promoting peace and security, but after 20 years, it left us with nothing but misery, poverty, unemployment, and now displacement.
Iran is already home to some 3 million Afghan refugees and economic migrants, the majority of whom are unregistered. Now with a dream for a bright future, these people hope that Iran's border will separate them from their tumultuous past. Yusuf Jalali from Iran-Afghanistan border.
Elsewhere, the death toll from an attack on a convoy of soldiers escorting civilians in Burkina Faso has risen to 80. In a statement, the government detailed that 59 civilians, that is, 6 militia men and 15 military officers were killed in the attack. Security forces said dozens of militants were also killed. The attack happened on Wednesday when militants opened fire on the convoy near the town of Arbinda in the country's north. The incident is the latest in a series of attacks across the West Africa's Sahel region this month. On Monday, armed men killed 37 civilians, including 14 children, in an attack on a village in Niger. Members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria have joined other Muslims worldwide in marking Ashura. Danjuma Abdullahi filed this report from Nigeria.
Members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, dressed in black, marched along major streets beating their chests in mourning over the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, his household, and his loyal companions in Karbala in present-day Iraq. The army of Yazid conducted the massacre in the most brutal manner.
They have shown merciless acts in that field, in which Imam Hussein and his whole household, his sahabas, in which they believe in him, and even babies in which they have been born, they have been killed.
Members of the Islamic movement said the Ashura is a time for sorrow and is a time for self-reflection when one commits oneself completely to the mourning of Imam Hussein. They said commemorating the martyrdom in Karbala signifies the ultimate prize in the pursuit of justice and righteousness.
The Ashura teaching, it teaches us to be honest in all our believing, to commit all our faith to Almighty Allah. We should not fear any creator in this earth if we want to fulfill our promise to be a good Muslim or to practice the religion of our Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his descendants the way it is.
According to the Islamic movement, the Ashura processions were conducted peacefully in many Nigerian cities. However, they said two people were killed in the northwestern Nigerian state of Sokoto, where the Nigeria police attacked the procession with live rounds. Danjuma Abdullahi, Suleja.
Muslims residing in Italy have commemorated Ashura, which marks the martyrdom anniversary of the grandson of the Prophet of Islam. Max Javidi is in Rome.
The 10th day of Muharram has been a day of mourning and commemoration of the martyrdom of the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, Hussein ibn Ali, also in Italy. Faithfuls from across the Italian peninsula met at Rome's Imam Mahdi Islamic Center to honor the Battle of Karbala and remember the sacrifices of the Imam Hussein, whose death is considered a symbol of the struggle against tyranny and injustice.
I have goosebumps when Ashura comes, and I move to tears when I listen to Imam Hussein's words. I always take my children to the Ashura ceremonies. I want them to understand what Imam Hussein did for us.
Ashura is everything to me. Ashura is death, rebirth, life. We have to follow Imam Hussein's example, the way he stood against his enemies, who were nothing but traitors.
The Ashura commemoration at the Imam Mahdi Islamic Center has been attended by Shia Muslims coming from a number of countries, including Afghanistan, Iran, Syria, India, and Moldavia.
Many at the Imam Mahdi Center here in Rome believe Ashura is not just a day in history. They are of the idea that Iran's consistency in resisting hegemony is rooted precisely in the culture of Ashura.
Our resistance to hegemonic plans is great thanks to the legacy of Imam Hussein. Active opposition to hegemony is possible through resistance at the level of everyday life. In fact, our faith reflects a model that can serve all societies.
Celebration at the Imam Mahdi Islamic Center have included performing tajieh, cooking various kinds of food and distributing it among the attendants, and a final speech by Sheikh Abbas Di Palma, in which he remembered the Battle of Karbala and the attack and the killing of Imam Hussein. Max Civili, Rome.
Turning elsewhere now, Brazil has logged over 36,000 new daily COVID-19 infections and 979 deaths. The figures brought the South American country's total confirmed cases to almost 20.5 million and its deaths at over 572,000. Brazil is the world's third worst hit nation in terms of coronavirus infections. It's also witnessed the world's second deadliest outbreak after the United States. In Mexico, more than 23,000 people have been diagnosed with the disease in a 24-hour time period. The country has also reported 850 new daily deaths. Mexican authorities say the actual figures are probably much higher than the official data. Brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box 19395-7 6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Indigenous groups in Canada are calling for a nationwide search for mass graves at residential school sites after the discovery of the remains of more than 200 children at one former school last week shocked the country. The Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said on Monday, 31st of May, that searching for more mass graves was an important part of discovering the truth, but did not make specific commitments. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the Reuters news agency with a contribution from the Associated Press. The piece is titled, Calls to Find All Canada's Indigenous Mass Graves After Grim Residential School Discovery. Indigenous groups in Canada are calling for a nationwide search for mass graves at residential school sites after the grim discovery of the remains of more than 200 children at one former school last week shocked the country. The Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said on Monday, 31st of May, that searching for more mass graves was, quote, an important part of discovering the truth, unquote. But Trudeau did not make specific commitments. Justin Trudeau said, as Prime Minister, I'm appalled by the shameful policy that stole Indigenous children from their communities. He added, sadly, this is not an exception or an isolated incident. Justin Trudeau added, we're not going to hide from that. We have to acknowledge the truth. Residential schools were a reality, a tragedy that existed here in Canada, in our country, and we have to own up to it. Kids were taken from their families, returned damaged, or not returned at all. Chief Roseanne Casimir of the Tekumloops Tesek Wapemk people said last week they had found the remains of 215 children, some as young as 3 years old, buried on the grounds of the Kamloops Indian Residential School, once Canada's largest such school, with the help of ground-penetrating radar. Chief Roseanne Casimir described the discovery as an unthinkable loss that was spoken about but never documented. In meetings across the country, Indigenous communities in Canada are now working to figure out how best to investigate, said Grand Chief Stuart Phillip, president of the Union of British Columbia Indian Chiefs. It's absolutely essential that there be a national program to thoroughly investigate all residential school sites in regard to unmarked mass graves, he said. Perry Bellegarde, chief of the Assembly of First Nations, has said, while it is not new to find graves at former residential schools, it's always crushing to have that chapter's wounds exposed. Meanwhile, the Federation of Sovereign Indigenous Nations and the Saskatchewan government have said they want Ottawa to help research undocumented deaths and burials, particularly at residential schools in the province. Federation Chief Bobby Cameron said finding the children's remains and giving them proper burials was important to help First Nation communities and families find closure. The Federation has compiled a list of initial sites where it hopes to complete radar ground searches. Saul Mamakwa, an opposition lawmaker with the New Democrat Party in Ontario, joined the call saying, "It's a great open secret that our children lie on the properties of former schools. It is an open secret that Canadians can no longer look away from." Between 1831 and 1996, Canada's residential school system forcibly separated more than 150,000 First Nation children from their families as part of a program to assimilate them into Canadian society. They were subjected to abuse, to malnutrition and rape in what the Truth and Reconciliation Commission tasked with investigating the system called a cultural genocide in 2015. They were forced to convert to Christianity and not allowed to speak their native languages. Canada's Indigenous leaders have cited that legacy of abuse and isolation as the root cause of epidemic rates of alcoholism and drug addiction on First Nation reservations. Opposition New Democrat leader Jagmeet Singh called on Monday for an emergency debate in the Canadian Parliament, saying, "Anytime we think about unmarked mass graves, we think about a distant country where a genocide has taken place. But this is not a distant country." Opposition Conservative lawmaker Michelle Rempel-Garner said, "This discovery is a stain on our country. It is one that needs to be rectified." Last week's announcement sparked outrage throughout Canada, prompting flags to be flown at half-mast and people to lay hundreds of tiny shoes in public squares, places of government, and on the streets and on the steps of churches, in reference to the role that the Christian churches from a range of denominations played out in running the schools. There have long been rumors within the Indigenous communities in Canada, also discussed by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, of children being buried at these schools. The Kamloops School operated between 1890 and 1969, where the federal government took over operations from the Catholic Church and operated it as a day school until it finally closed down in 1978. The fourth volume of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's report, titled Missing Children and Unmarked Burials, identified 3,200 children who died at residential schools throughout Canada, about a third of whom were not named. Since that report's publication in 2015, an additional 900 children have been identified. Parents spoke of children who went to school and never returned home, the report says. A working group established by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in 2007 proposed, among other things, a study to identify unmarked grave sites in Canada. While the federal government initially denied the $1.5 million Canadian dollars needed to conduct this work, the Canadian government announced in 2019 a $33.8 million Canadian dollar over 3 years for a national residential school student death register and an online registry of residential school cemeteries. Richard Gagnon, Archbishop of Winnipeg and President of the Canadian Conference of Catholic Bishops, said he wanted to express our deepest sorrow for the heart-rending loss of the children at the former Kamloops Indian Residential School.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality. Back to
it's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Back to Reality. In the studio with me, I have the honor of hosting two special guests. And without further ado, we're going to begin with their introduction and jump straight into our discussion. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, Sayyid.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for being with us. Salam, bro.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. How are you?
Inshallah. I'm very well, thank you.
Brother Yasir from South Africa.
Thank you for being with us.
Sayyid Abdullah Musa from Australia.
All right. Thank you so very much for joining us. Gentlemen, you both, luckily South Africa and Australia, are both very diverse countries and regions, and you've probably come across a lot of different cultures and people and traditions and religions and denominations. I want us today to talk about our different experiences regarding the mourning ceremonies for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
Alhamdulillah, I've had the experience of seeing the majalis or the commemoration in about four or five different countries. South Africa being one of them, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
England, Australia also I've been. Iran, obviously, Iraq.
Mm-hmm. So you've basically been to every continent?
Yeah? Yes, basically, besides North America.
That's okay.
Yeah,
that's not a lot.
That doesn't really count, no. So, unfortunately, one of the things is that we see a lot of cultural influence in a lot of these centers, mm-hmm. unfortunately.
Unfortunately,
because, for example, I give South Africa as a bad example, because Africa as a country is very different to the others.
Yeah.
In terms that the majority of the Shia are not immigrants. They did not come from other countries or not second generation from other countries. Meaning that the majority of the Shia are from the country themselves. They became Shia after the Islamic Revolution.
Okay.
So, like Nigeria, well, majority of countries in Africa are like that.
Right.
Like,
which
for
is
example,
a good thing.
Which is a good, no, that's what I'm saying. It's a very good thing. Mm. This is what it's supposed to be. But unfortunately, what I mentioned is that when you have a group of people who come and they want to do things the way they did it back home, it creates friction between them and the local population, who are, in this case, the majority.
Mm.
And there's also, like, you know, lack of working together and so on. And also, it creates a division amongst the different communities in that particular country.
Us and them.
Like, I went to Australia, I went to Melbourne.
Right. Right?
The Afghani community doesn't know.
Wait,
the Iraqi
Sayyid, which
community.
Part of Australia are you from?
Melbourne.
Okay.
So I went to Melbourne. I was in Victoria. There's a masjid I was there for 40, a couple years ago.
Mashallah.
Right? I was there for about 10 days. And alhamdulillah, I created, like, I tried to get in touch with as many communities as I could.
Mm.
But those communities themselves never got in touch with themselves. Never.
Among themselves,
Among themselves,
right?
There was never anything to do with one another. Even within the same cultural community, there was a split.
Which defeats the objective of Imam al-Hussein.
So it was a bit, like I said, this is the political side of it. But in terms of, like, the gatherings and in terms of the differences of, like, in, you see differences, like majority I attended had a Indo or subcontinental type of flair to it.
Mm-hmm.
Iran has its own thing. Iraqis have their own thing.
Which one do you prefer personally?
I don't know, actually.
Really? I mean, which ritual, which cultural ritual of mourning do you prefer? Which one do you vibe with better?
I think...
the Iranian one, isn't it?
In terms of the speeches and stuff, the Iranians, because... the Farsi ones, rather.
Yeah, because you studied in their
Because
language.
I've studied Farsi, yeah. I understand the language, and the knowledge and the preferences that come in terms of the ilm, like, it also depends on the speaker, right?
Mm.
It depends on the speaker as well. In English, unfortunately, you know, it's a skill and it's a thing that needs to be worked on.
Yeah.
Especially the masa'ib. There's very few people in English who can do it. I'm not one of them, so
Understandable.
I'm not one of them also.
So Sayyidna, you just mentioned that you're from Australia, Melbourne, Australia. Which community are you from? With which community do you have experience?
For me, I don't have a special, I mean, my background, I'm Iraqi by descent.
Right.
But when it comes to the majalis, since I was young, from a very young age. I was pretty much the only one delivering lectures in English. I never delivered a lecture in Arabic. So I
in Australia.
In Australia. So
right.
I pretty much got to all centers. I get invited by all of them.
The Iraqis, the
Iraqis,
Afghans,
the Pakis, Iranians. So whatever center there is, because they all have English spoken youth and young kids and young generation. So they need someone to cater for that. So the older generation, they would have people of their own language. But when it comes to English, for example, we have that lack, like the brother said, we had the lack of English speakers. So I had the pleasure of pretty much going everywhere and delivering lecture in every center. So I did not find any boundaries when it came to community.
So maybe you didn't find a boundary as a speaker. But do you think the listeners had boundaries? Did you see familiar, like, did you, like, see, I don't know, Jassim in an Iraqi center, and then you went to the Afghani center in the evening, and there was Jassim again? No, it was all different people, each place. They don't mingle.
No, so the idea is not about mingling. The idea is that how should I put it? Each culture or each community, we as human beings, we like to stay with our own kind, to say the least. So if I'm an Afghan, if I'm a Paki, if I'm an Iraqi, I would go to my own centers, to my own people that
they
provide.
So you think
provide.
That's cool, that's fine, that's nothing wrong with it.
Of course it's fine in the sense that, you know, you hang around with your own people. That's not a problem, there's not an issue there. Mm. As long as obviously if you don't have a feud and arguments and fights with the other people, which I never saw, right?
Oh,
like the brother
said.
So the brother said that that each community they preserve, they have their own thing going, but they never have an issue with other center. For example, I know all the centers in Melbourne. I've never seen one center have another problem with another center, or even for example, sometimes within the one community you find like few centers.
Yeah,
like they divided,
right.
as we use the word divided, which is a disadvantage. But in fact, you know, sometimes division is also could be a good thing, right? You can grab more people from different aspects. You know, for example, if I have an issue with that center, I don't have an issue with that center. So I go to the other center, you know what I mean? So even that division creates an opportunity for those who have a problem with a specific center.
You're pro-variety when it comes to this.
So obviously unity is the best thing, but if it's not there, let's work around with it.
Right,
you know what I mean?
Right.
So like I said, people like to go to their own centers, and they would like their own centers to provide someone with the for them.
We're going
to
be back after a short break, so stay tuned.
Oh, oh, shahidan to ya Hussein. Oh, arsar khan to ya Hussein. Oh, edelam asrat Karbala. Oh, Karbala, Karbala, Karbala.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, to Back to Reality. Here in the studio, we're discussing the concept of having majalis for Muharram and Safar, which are upon us. Whose morning rituals did you find most interesting?
They pretty much all the same. It begins with the Rosa lecture, and then there's a Latmiya at the end, right? So it's pretty much the same. But what's different is sometimes it's a lecturer and the lecture itself. For example, the topic that he would speak about in one center, it might be a different lecture somewhere else. But when it comes to the azza aspect of it, they all speak the same musiba, same tragedy, but in different language. When they beat their chest and it's time for azza as well, it's just a different poetry, and people do let them do it in their own way.
Mm.
So it's the exact same thing, just the flavor is a bit different, if I say this.
Brother Yasser, among all the experiences you've had with different ceremonies and cultures when it comes to mourning, which specific ritual you felt really grasped your heart, captured your senses, make you really connect with that scenario of tragedy?
There was one thing that happened in South Africa. There were, as I mentioned, a lot of the South African Shia were either Christian or atheist.
Beautiful.
Or Sunni, and became Shia afterwards. There was a brother who was a Christian, and he was in the church choir. He recited a lakmiya in his own in one of the languages, and it was really, you know, heart-rending. Even though I didn't understand what he was saying completely, but the way he recited it, the depth, the tune, you know, was quite it took me quite aback. That even like, yes, okay, we still have the culture of mourning, but we do it in our own language, in our own style. Another one I listened to recently was from the West Indies. I can't remember exactly which island, but they were actually rapping lakmiya.
Seriously?
In reggae. They were doing it in reggae.
That's amazing.
And it was, I have a clip. I have it. I'll send it. It's a it was beautiful. I got, and I saw this and I said, you know, it's, you know, you don't have to do it in a particular way that a southern culture came and taught you. And unfortunately, this is different. This is specific to certain of the colonized countries, is that, you know, those people who were colonized, they always have this, I don't know how to put it, but they have this kind of view of the other.
Mm.
Especially like when it came to Islam in these countries as well. Islam was brought to them by culture, and they saw it, and they were like, you know, this is not what it is for us. So these are some of the things that I noticed that, you know, they took me aback that, you know, you have these things that, you know, Islam as a religion, Imam Hussein al-Islam as the ideal of that religion, as a person who, you know, encapsulates the ideals of that religion. It can be done in any language, in any form. And for me, as a person who may not even understand that language, you know, I should be attached to that person of what he is doing, not because of what language he's speaking.
True.
Not because of what culture he comes from. Mm. Like, I'll give, you know, I went to Melbourne, there was a group of youth, alhamdulillah, I got a tell from different centers.
Mm.
And I brought them together, and I asked one of the brothers, I said, look, we have a hadith that says that, you know, in the time of the Imam, alayhi salam, a brother will be able to put his hand in the pocket of another brother and take his need without the other brother asking.
Mm.
So I said, if you don't know who your brother is, where are you going to put your hand?
Good point.
And,
yeah.
You know, one of the things I tried, and wherever I tried to go, I tried to bring, especially the youth, because unfortunately the older generations, you know, is difficult. Not say it's impossible, it's really difficult. England is the same as well. Unfortunately, there's a lot of differences and feuds as well in England. It's not like there are a lot
there's
of feuds.
Beef. Right, unfortunately.
So unfortunately, this is one of the things, that one of the examples I saw that, you know, that really took me aback was this type of lakmiyas in these type of thing that you never expect it to be.
I would like to redirect the same question to you. What specific ritual in the morning ceremonies have you seen that make you feel, wow, that's really something?
Nothing.
Seriously?
No, so the thing is, when it comes to Azza, at the end of the day, everyone does it his own way, in his own language.
So nothing interested you, or was it all wow to you?
No, that didn't interest me. It's just, like I said, I find it all the same to me. If you speak to me about Abu Abdullah alayhi salam in whatever language, in whatever way, I'm moved.
I never notice how different you two people are.
Yeah. So
SubhanAllah.
Yeah. So
totally different
and each
answers.
Person, mind you, each person, at the end of the day, there's something that moves them. Like the brother said, for example, some kids or some young kids maybe rap.
Mm.
About Karbala would move them. Some people just said normal lakmiya would move them. So each one moves in his own way.
Feel ashamed that I never could connect with English lakmiyas?
Yeah, so everybody, at the end of the day, I kind of get turned off by English lakmiyas, to be quite honest, to say the least.
So you only like to listen to it in your native language?
No, I like to listen to it in Urdu, for example, in Turkish. Sometimes I don't understand what they're saying, but you can feel the passion in them. The only problem with English is that it doesn't have that passion.
It's such a neutral language.
Yeah, it doesn't have that passion. So no matter how you sing it, it doesn't have the passion.
Mm.
For example, I've seen a lot of Paki, Indian, Turkish, Azerbaijani, Persian. Even if you don't understand it, it moves you from within.
Mm.
But like I said, everyone has
their
his own preference.
Yeah.
Everyone has his own wow factor, like you said. But for me personally, I find anything about Abdullah as a wow.
That's great. May Allah increase that, and may Allah increase both your tawfiqs in the path of serving the master of martyrs, salamullah alayhi. Thank you so very much for your time, gentlemen, and thank you so much to our listeners for being with us. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
شهیدان تو یا حسین، آه ار سرخان تو یا حسین، آه
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
محرم سپیشال In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Today is the 10th of Muharram, known as Ashura. This is the second year that the mourning ceremonies of Imam Hussein are held mainly in open spaces due to the spread of coronavirus pandemic. Ashura is the day of the greatest epic of history and the most heart-rending catastrophe of mankind, namely the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, and his loyal companions, and the captivity of the women and the children of his encampment. It is the afternoon of Ashura, and Hussein, the younger grandson of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, has been surrounded by the mean enemies. The Imam bids his last farewell to his family and relatives and hugs his six-month son, Ali Asghar. As he hears the harrowing cries of the thirsty infant, raises him high, asking the enemies for a drop of water to the parched lips of the innocent infant. But the despicable and stone-hearted Harmale targets the suckling fine throat with a three-pronged arrow, only to end his cries. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, sprinkles the blood of his six-month infant to the sky and ask God to accept this sacrifice. The moments pass very hard, but the Imam's face is glowing more and more as he nears martyrdom. His fighting reminds the enemies of his father, Imam Ali, peace upon him. Suddenly, one of the enemies strikes him on the left arm and shoulder. As the grandson of the Prophet has sustained myriads of injuries and lost his ability, he falls down from the horse, but his divine awe and grandeur does not let any of the godless forces to come closer to him. Finally, a miserable, ruthless man strikes the Imam with a huge lance. The stroke delves into the helmet and blood gushes out from Imam Hussein's head. But to the amusement of all, he is supplicating to God with the words, "My God, I am satisfied with your satisfaction and submitted to your command." Umar Sa'ad, the commander of Yazid's troops, shouts, "Woe upon you! Dismount and finish with Hussein." Sanan bin Anas dismounts and goes to Imam Hussein. He puts his dagger on the Imam's sacred throat, saying, "By God, I will decapitate you while I know that you are the grandson of the Messenger of God, and your parents are the best of the people on the earth." The sky is gloomy as the truth has been mounted on spearhead. Ashura has transcended centuries and generations and has become brighter and brighter while inspiring all freedom seekers in every place. But what is the mystery? The bloods of Imam Hussein, his near ones and companions, were not like that of ordinary people. Imam Hussein's blood was the purest and holiest blood that was shed on the soil of Karbala. Imam Hussein could have saved his life, but he obeyed God's command and sacrificed whatever he had for the survival of God's religion. He was the one whose voice keeps resonating through the history when he said, "Do you not see that the truth is not practiced and the falsehood is not prevented?"
Ashura have become the yardstick for truth and falsehood till the end of history. Truth is authentic and eternal, while falsehood is fabricated and transient. Falsehood is like the foam of water. In Ayah 17 of Surah Rat of the Noble Quran, we read, He sends down water from the sky, whereat the valleys are flooded to their capacity, and the flood carries along a swelling scum. That is how Allah compares the truth and falsehood. As for the scum, it leaves as dross, and that which profits the people remains in the earth. That is how Allah draws comparisons. The Ahlul Bayt, or progeny of the Prophet of Islam, is the axis of truth and the guide of the Ummah. Whenever truth is deviated, they show the right path. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says in Nahjul Balagha, Where are you going and where are you turning your faces? The flags of truth are set up and its signs are clear. With these lights that have been installed, where are you going in astray? And why are you wandering while the progeny of your prophet is among you? They are the leaders of truth, the flags of religion, and the tongues of honesty. Place them in the best place that you keep the Quran, and like the thirsty, rush to their clear spring to be satiated. Greetings to the master of martyrs, Hussein, the inheritor of all divine messengers from Adam to Muhammad, and greetings to the souls that joined him.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.